Hello, and welcome to IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast, brought to you by Learning Essentials. Learning Essentials offers special education-based tutoring in your home by state-certified educators with advanced degrees in all areas of special education. IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast brings professionals together to educate and empower families navigating special education needs in the IEP process.
Welcome to the IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. If you want more information and tips, you can follow us on Instagram at Learning Essentials. I'm really excited today for our conversation with Andrea Malkin-Brenner. And today we're talking about college insider tips, and it's not all academic. So hang on, listen, grab a notepad, and get ready. So Andrea Malkin-Brenner, PhD, is a college transition educator and author who works with high school students and their parents on the challenges related to college transitions, including a specific focus on students with mental health challenges and learning differences. Andrea is a frequent speaker and a workshop facilitator. She draws on her 25 years of experience, most of them at American University in Washington, D.C., as a college sociology professor, college administrator, and creator and director of first year experience programs. She also directed AU's University College Program, the university's oldest and largest living learning community for first year students. Dr. Brenner has received multiple awards for her teaching and program design and frequently speaks about first-year transition challenges to families, high schools, and colleges. She is the co-author of How to College, What to Know Before You Go and When You're There, and was the 2019-2020 Fellow at University of California National Center for Free Speech and Civic Engagement. Dr. Brenner holds a BA in sociology from Brandeis University, a master's in curriculum instruction and administration in higher education from Boston College, and a PhD in sociology from American University. Welcome, Dr. Brenner. Thank you so much for joining us. And I'm excited for this conversation, especially as a lot of kiddos are thinking about moving on to college and wondering what that's going to look like. And so I'm excited that your tips in our conversation today aren't all going to be academic driven and really kind of give that insider look at what to do and how to prepare and what to do once you get there. So welcome. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Wendy. I appreciate it.
So let's jump in here. What are the biggest obstacles students face when they transition into college?
So I would say really lacking the understanding of the differences between high school and college level academics. And there are so many. One that just pops into my mind is the fact that high school teachers frequently remind students about assignments. You know, you've got this quiz coming up on Thursday. Don't forget to turn in your assignment next week, et cetera. And college is a totally different game. The students are given, in most situations, the students are given a syllabus on the first day of class, if not before, given electronically. And the student is required to really follow their assignments without those frequent prompts and reminders. So there are many differences between high school and college academics. That would just be one of them. I would also say another obstacle, and it's probably a biggie, is not being prepared to handle mistakes when they happen. And they will be fast and furious. The first year of college, absolutely, mistakes are normative, they're expected. And college administrators like to say it's not really what happens, it's what the student does when they happen. So the more prepared students can be from any possible situation occurring, from, you know, getting a laptop stolen to losing their student ID, those are things that they should talk about in advance with their families and make a plan for action.
What are some common I wish I would have known responses or takeaways that incoming freshmen have?
What adulting means, I would say, is probably the big one. And that's something I like to talk about. I talk about in my book, and I talk to parents in parent workshops frequently. I think if you ask adults, or, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, what it means to be an adult, I think they would talk about relying on others, right? That could be Googling information if it's something they don't know, or if there's a crisis in a family, you know, really calling friends and family for help, finding support. And that's what it actually means to be an adult, knowing how you can get support and get help to move forward. But if you ask a high school senior or a first-year college student what adulting means, you know, I would say their responses are twofold. One, they would say it's this big, scary thing out there. They have no idea what it really means. It's sort of this unknown. And the other is it means doing things completely independently. And that is a fallacy. That is truly a mistake. And I think it adds a lot of stress to first-year students' lives. So I would say the best thing we can do as teachers, as parents, and as college administrators is to prepare students for the fact that adulting actually means reaching out to resources, knowing when you are in need, and finding the help rather than trying to do it all on your own.
You mentioned being prepared, reactions to when things, a laptop getting stolen, grade you don't get, a myriad of things, and then getting help. How do you kind of suggest parents or students start to pave that way? And when do they start paving that way and having that conversation of what to do when things are not going your way? How do you get help? How do you reach out? How do you respond?
So I think that's a whole host of great questions. And there's not one monolithic, you know, first year college experience. Students with neurodiversity issues might need to start some of these challenges and chunk them, break them down earlier and talk through the different pieces. And other students, you know, might be able to start talking about it the 11th grade year, even up to the summer before college. So that's really independent on how your student thinks, learns, and processes. But the key is to have these conversations. And I think part of the problem is that, especially if it is the first student going off to college, most of the information that family holds is about the parents, you know, a college experience, if the parents did go to college, or at least the parents' experience leaving the home at age 18 or 19, which may have been 30 years ago, and the world is a very different place. There's so many opportunities to combat this, and I would say one of them is reach out to family and friends, anybody you might know who is a college junior or senior, and ask them honestly, you know, what challenges did you face or what challenges did your peers face in college? And, you know, how best could you have been prepared? That's one of the things that we actually do in our How to College book is we spent hundreds of hours talking to college students and their parents, asking them, what did you discuss and what do you wish you had discussed before transitioning to college? So, you know, either relying on resources like my book, other books, or talking to people you know and getting the real story about what college is like today matters so much for that student experience.
What are some of the biggest mistakes students make when they first go away for school?
There are quite a few, I would say. I would say not understanding the differences between high school and college. And I do think that there's a misconception that the day the college acceptance letter arrives by email now, not in the mailbox, that means that student has officially transitioned and they're all set. I would actually argue that is not the case, that indeed that's the day the hard work begins, because you're moving on to that new world. The conversations that have to take place between parents and students are far greater than people realize. So some of that's what I mentioned earlier, you know, planning for challenges, but also digging down into that student's learning and thinking process. So the parent, better than anyone, knows, for example, if their student has trouble getting up with an alarm, if that student is, struggles with remembering to pack their soccer jersey, whatever that specific child is struggling with. I think those are the conversations, because the goal for everybody, and certainly for the parents and the student, is that the student is much more independent going forward. So how should parents work to move to helping their child make decisions independently? And sometimes it's a very long process. I know a lot of parents begin in middle school. One of the things I would stress, and it's amazing in so many conversations I've had with parents, this comes up again and again: my kid doesn't know how to talk on the phone. And that is something that's really interesting, because of course, those of us who went to college many years ago, you know, we spent many, many hours on the phone. So familiarizing your student with things like leaving a professional voicemail, making a dentist appointment. And if your child struggles with those, if they have some anxiety in that, there's ways to break it down. So for example, something I like to talk to parents about is your child, by the time they go to college, should be making all of their own doctor's appointments. That's something that they should be able to handle. That's a college-ready skill, in my opinion. But again, we don't want our child to go from dependence to independence overnight. It's a gradual process. So for example, you might want to say, all right, kid, I'm going to make this appointment for you. I'm going to be on speakerphone so you can hear the conversation. And then the next appointment, maybe it's a haircut, maybe it's a dentist, will be on speakerphone and I'll be listening. You make the appointment. And hopefully by the third time, you should be able to handle that independently.
I think that's an excellent piece of advice. 100%. And I've shared similar thoughts to students that I support and even my own personal kiddos in terms of being able to speak on the phone, to have a conversation. And like you said, to be able to leave a professional voicemail. If they're going to leave a voicemail for their professors, that's very different than leaving a voicemail for your pal, right?
That's correct.
Also, in that tone of practicing writing professional emails and that advocacy piece for yourself and that independent part, starting even in middle school, emailing your teacher if you have a question so that they can practice what that looks like, because the language that you're putting in an email is very different than you would text to your friend.
With, no question, you know, about it. Yeah.
Making sure that you're actually writing out a word and not abbreviating it. And I like the idea of kind of doing that scaffolding of you demonstrating how to leave that voicemail and then have the kiddo start to practice on their own with you right there. So if there's a question that the person on the other end asks and the student's not very sure how to do that, you know, the parent can help kind of guide so that they have that strategy, those life strategies prior to going to college. How can students prepare for specific stressors, like being away from their families for the first time?
I think first we should acknowledge that it's not going to be perfect, right? That as I mentioned, mistakes before are normative, but college should be stressful. But there's a continuum between stress and distress. And I think that that's, you know, certainly college counselors talk about this, counseling centers talk about this. And that's something that parents and college-bound students should really talk about, because it's different for every college student. How does stress look to you? How does it affect your body? How does it affect your diet? How does it affect your head, your ability to process? And then if you have ever been in a situation where that stress has moved to distress, what does that look like? And what are those warning signs? So again, those conversations, preparing to handle those stressors. The game plan, I would argue, should not be to call home every time that there is an issue or a challenge. And I think that that's something we need to be working towards with first year students, right? So you're used to being an AB student in high school, for example, and you get to college and you get your first chemistry test back and you have a C. Is that student's first plan of action to text parent and to say, oh my gosh, I'm freaking out. What should I do? I'm a failure. I'm a this. Or is it to go internal, to think about what this means, and then to come up with a plan of action? And again, that's something we can talk about in our families, we talk about in my book, but a plan of action for that scene might be, I'm going to make my first appointment with my professor or my graduate TA for the class, go with that test in hand and say, I'm not a C student, or I don't want to be a C student. Can you help me figure out how to do better next time? So it doesn't mean that we can't converse with parents. I mean, that's absolutely a support system that first year students need. But ultimately, the goal would be to problem solve ourselves as first year students and then rely on parents for support. And I mean, you can start that as early as sort of ninth grade, eighth grade, starting to learn to problem solve. And I think ultimately, if you're a parent, when your young teen comes to you and says, I have a problem, what should I do? We can try to help them rework that language to say, I have a problem. I thought about it. Here's my plan. What do you think? Doesn't mean the parent's not involved, because they can certainly say, I have a better idea, or maybe you can rethink it this way. But the idea is that the problem-solving process should be coming from the student themselves.
Excellent. And you're right. Start early. There's no reason to start all of this summer before college. start these conversations as early as possible. What campus resource should students be aware of for social, emotional support, mental wellness, overall guidance? I know every college is different.
Every college is different, and every one of those centers is called something different, right? So that's a little confusing sometimes. There's always a counseling center, might not be called that, but there's always a counseling center that can offer psychological support. Most families don't realize that usually between 6 and 8 counseling sessions are included in the tuition that you're already paying for your student. That's something to keep in mind. You might be meeting with a psychology doctoral student, not necessarily a full-blown psychologist at first, but the options are there for sure. So I would say the counseling center, knowing where it is. Why is it important to actually have walked to the front door and know where it is? And I can't stress this enough, because when a student is in crisis or moves from, as I mentioned, that stress to distress continuum, the last thing they need is to figure out how to get to the counseling center. So it should be a place that they are familiar with. Even if they never use it, they should already know in advance where it is. The health and fitness center, great way to let off steam, obviously, to stay in shape. There's usually a wellness center or a health and wellness center on campus. Sometimes it's attached to the physical health center. And that's everything from sexual health to stress reduction, yoga, meditation, all different things. And again, these are almost always included in a student's tuition. So many resources on campus. And that's not even talking about academic resources, which are also plentiful.
Dr. Brenner, as you're speaking, I'm thinking, and I hear this from parents that we support through Learning Essentials, we hit the magical age of 18. What information do you want to share to parents, what that means, and to students of what that means to be 18? When we're specifically talking about mental health, grades, any of that?
If I can, I'd love to talk a little bit about FERPA. And I think that's something that families really need to know. So FERPA is the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act. And it's a federal law that protects the privacy of all student records when the student becomes 18, or even if the student is under 18 and they are attending a post-secondary institution. So they could be a 17-year-old college student, FERPA still applies. And basically what families need to know is that unless a student signs a waiver giving the parent access, FERPA, this federal law, prohibits the college from providing parents with information about 6 main things: their child's grades, child's accommodations, that's any kind of learning accommodations, their students' academic progress, even their child's tuition notifications, which drives parents nuts because in most situations, parents are paying for some, if not all, of the college experience. Academic probation, that's another one that a parent would not be notified if their student was on academic probation. And the last one is scholarship information. So that's a lot of big stuff that can affect your student. Am I encouraging parents and students to talk about FERPA? Absolutely. Is it a good idea for your particular college student to sign the waiver and allow parents access to that? I can't answer that question. That is, again, not a monolithic story. But I do think that parents should think about, do they really need to have access to all of these items? In my particular situation, I have 2 kids. I have a daughter who's already graduated from college. I have a son who's a freshman in college. We did not have him sign a FERPA waiver. That said, we do pay for his tuition. And so it is our family's understanding that he will share his grades with us. So there are ways to do it. You can also sign a FERPA waiver and only hold that for the first year of college and say, if all goes well and we feel like you've got it under control, we will totally release that sophomore year and feel that, you know, it's your responsibility to be in charge of these things. So FERPA, I would say, is absolutely crucial to understand. A lot of parents feel frustrated that they feel kicked out by the process, especially if they've been their student support or advocate for, you know, K-12, and then all of a sudden they don't have access to these things without a legal waiver. But the introduction of FERPA is a huge step towards adulting and towards the independence that college is really supposed to deliver.
Back to our mental health question. Sure. And FERPA. If there is a situation where a student needs mental health services, how do you guide parents with that conversation in regards to FERPA, and how do you create that balance that they feel that their child is safe, but they may not have access to the information?
So that's a really great question. And I would say it's the same answer I keep giving you again and again. It's plan, talk in advance, right? So students should be able to access resources on campus for sure. And I would say, number one, on move-in day, if it's acceptable, I would encourage roommates, parents to get each other's cell phone numbers. That's a wonderful, you know, of course, if everyone has to be on board, but to me, that's a health and safety piece. Also, for parents to have the roommate's contact information, because that's a phone call you want to get. My roommate didn't come home tonight. That's a phone call that a parent wants to get. Also, access to the RA and their contact information, the resident assistant or resident advisor, because that is usually the first line person in the student's world where they can go to for any kind of mental health issues. Now, the RA is usually a junior or a senior, so they're not providing the mental health counseling session to the student, but they are hooking them up with the resources on campus. So have a plan, number one, understand the differences between stress and distress, and what we will do if a situation moves from stress to distress, knowing that stress is normative, and then lining up resources in case there is a problem.
Excellent. What are some things parents should do and should avoid doing when helping their student transition to college?
This might be my favorite question. There are many, many things. So number one, parents should avoid answering emails on behalf of their child. And we see this again and again. Not only is it actually illegal, but it is not the precedent to set with your student, right? So students will need to answer lots of emails in college. It's the way the college communicates with students, academic advisors, deans, and of course, professors. That's all. Nobody's texting you. That's all coming by email. So students really need to understand professional email dialogue, communication, and need to be regularly checking that email. So as soon as you put down a deposit for a college, you've accepted, you put down a deposit, you will, within a few days, you will be getting your new email address for your college. And that student should start every single day checking that email. And there will be many, many emails in the beginning. So I would say, number one, parents should avoid answering emails for their child. Number two, avoid searching the internet for answers about things that your student can find on their own. So suggesting the search for answers is a great thing for parents to do, right? You have a problem. Hey, have you looked at the Academic Affairs website to find out how many credits you're going to need? But looking up items like the hours of the healthcare center or the email for a department chair, that's not the precedent, again, we want to set. And what I want to remind parents is that, remember that your student will be required to conduct college level academic research in college. They can certainly handle the small stuff like finding office hours. So that's something that, you know, I would strongly encourage parents to do. And if students ask them, can you check this for me? You know, I would push back and say, you're about to go to college. You're going to have to find out far more important information than this. I'm sure it's something that you can handle. And then I would also say parents should avoid making phone calls to the college on behalf of their child, unless there is a significant health issue. 17 to 19 year olds, again, as I mentioned before, they're not super familiar with speaking professionally on the phone. It's something they should be practicing. But that is something that a parent can do so easily. And so sometimes we rush to do things to fix the situation, but we should really, it's the best thing to do is to encourage our student to make those phone calls on their own.
It's that switch, right, from being kind of with your younger children, you're guiding them, you're molding them, you're having conversations, to kind of stepping back and being more of kind of the collaborator and the support, and let our students make those decisions. And sometimes it may not work in their favor, but I think that gives that life opportunity for those conversations to kind of problem solve with your child and say this, you know, oh, why do you think this didn't work? And what could we have done differently? And it's easier to recover when we're younger from mistakes, you know, and that doesn't have to be some global mistake and huge mistake, but it gives us those baseline skills, right?
I agree 100%. And I think we need to tease them out. And of course, they're different in every family. For example, I would think that it's inappropriate for the parent of a first year student to say, I'm calling you in the morning to make sure you're up for your final. But it might be appropriate to text to say, remember your vaccine is today, right? Because one is, you know, health and safety in a global pandemic, and the other is something that worse come to worse. The student figures out what it means not to show up for a test, right? And then they'll have to go to their professor and they'll have to figure out the solution and possibly live with the consequences. So it's a continuum, and it's very hard sometimes for parents to tease out where they can let their student gently fail or gently fail to thrive and learn from those mistakes versus, you know, mistakes that are sending someone off a cliff.
Well, and I like how you said that fail to thrive and gently make mistakes is kind of what I was trying to say, but you said it so much cleaner and eloquent than I did, for sure. But, you know, I think ultimately, again, you know, you're talking about emails, looking up information, making these phone calls. These are all life skills. Absolutely. Right. And so when you're out into the real world in a job situation, it is our hope that our kiddos can wake up when they need to and arrive to their meetings on time post-secondary. And so as a parent, if you're texting your student, wake up, it's not really setting them up for success post-secondary.
I would agree.
Under what circumstances or situations should parents step in with the school, if ever?
So I would say anything that is health and safety related, and really those are probably, and health would be physical and mental health, health and safety related when it's something that's too big for the student to handle on their own, right? So not feeling well and going to the health center to get a strep throat swab, that's something a student can handle on their own for sure. But a student feeling out of control, a student so ill that they can't get out of bed, those are something where a student with a parent is completely appropriate for them to step in. And there's many ways to do it. You know, you don't need to start at the top by calling the dean's student's office. You can start with the roommate, with the RA. And again, not for the roommate or the RA necessarily to solve the problem, but to alert the next step. So maybe to reach out to the counseling center, reach out, even to have a meal delivered if the student is sick. Most colleges and universities will have some sort of service if the student can't leave their room because they're too ill, that they'll deliver a meal on the meal plan to the room. So those are all things that if the student is unable to handle them, the parent can certainly feel comfortable doing that. And there will be opportunities where the college will actually reach out in a crisis to the parent. But that's not most situations during the first year of college.
We spent a lot of our time right now just talking about while a student is on campus. Let's take a step back. What level of guidance recommendations should parents provide about where to go to school, what to study, courses to take, kind of that high school prepping?
That's a terrific question. And again, not one monolithic story. Some people use an independent educational counselor to help kind of hone in. There are so many guides and resources out there, both online and in hard copy. The FISK guide, F-I-S-K-E, is one that I often suggest. It's a fantastic book. It's been around for many, many years. And if the student can kind of hone in on the type of school they're interested in, it'll give a list of similar schools. So that's one way to go about it. And I would say that starting the process slow really helps. So by sophomore year of high school, I encourage parents to encourage their students not to rule in schools, but to rule out schools, right? So for example, it's an East Coast student who decides, you know what, I don't want to be across the country from my family. So I'm going to rule out the West Coast entirely. Or I've taken family vacations and just really cities scare me and I don't want to go to school in a city, right? Or I love the busyness of a city and I don't want, cow tipping rural place. So I would say ruling out is an early process, maybe even sophomore to early junior year. And then spending junior year kind of honing in on what schools feel right, obviously in their academic realm as well. And one of the mistakes I do see parents make again and again is, first of all, thinking back 30 years ago to their own college experiences. Colleges are ranked so differently now than they were back then. So that's one piece. But we see so often parents guiding the search process. And if a student doesn't have someone to turn to, who else are they going to do? You know, but they're going to listen to their parent, right? So I would absolutely, public and private school, high school students, I would say use that college guidance office. Those are people who are trained. They have had thousands of students with similar stories go through. Use them, ask for help, ask for resources. Nobody expects you know, the day you enter junior year for this all to click and you to understand the process. So keep asking questions.
And it's overwhelming. And I know that the idea, you know, especially here in the DC area, we have access to so many colleges. You know, we have the urban setting, rural, you know, anywhere in between, from big, small. And I've even suggested to parents, just even if you're not planning to attend one of those colleges or universities, just drive and have your kiddo experience, you know, walk around the campus to kind of get that feeling. Cause sometimes, like you said, kids don't know if I want, you know, the Big Ten, do I want a tiny one? Do I want, you know, just to kind of start that conversation of getting the feel of what that would even look like.
That's a great idea. And I also, you know, pre-COVID would also encourage the same thing. A little bit more challenging with tours today, but DC area is a great example. You can, you know, go to GW and walk around a real city school. You can go to American University and walk around sort of a closed suburban campus, get a feel for what that feels like. And then you can go to University of Maryland and you can experience, you know, the big sports arena right in the middle of campus and get the size of that at a state school. So that's wonderful experience to do that. And I think that advice is terrific.
What resources do you recommend for families to ease the transition?
So, of course, I would love if everyone bought my book.
Absolutely.
Because it's filled with exercises for college-bound students and prompts for parents and college-bound students. But again, asking questions. And I want to come back to that, because asking questions is something in the K-12 world that means I don't understand. Maybe I'm not the smartest one in the class. Adulting is all about asking questions. And a college professor is thrilled when students ask questions, because it means they want to dig to the next level, right? They really are trying to learn. It doesn't mean that they are, you know, lacking intelligence by any means. So I would say, most importantly, ask questions. Parents and students start talking about issues in advance that might arise during their first year based on who that kid is. That includes what to do in an emergency, if something is lost or stolen, how to notice if a friend or a peer is in need of help, how to budget your money and time. The most important thing that parents and students can do is to talk. And I would nod to students. 17 to 19 year olds are not always the best communicators, but I want, you know, college-bound students to also think about these conversations and to realize that this is an opportunity for you to shine and have some adult conversations. You know, one word grunts or answers is not necessarily the way to engage. And that those early conversations with your parents are going to prep you for college-level conversations that you're going to be having very soon.
And you brought this up, and I was going to talk about it at the end of our conversation, but, you know, your book, How to College, What to Know Before You Go and When You're There, is packed with a lot of this guidance. Do you want to share a little bit about that? You know, kind of just pause our conversation now, because it really does help guide students on what to expect and how to kind of prepare for this and beyond.
Sure, absolutely. So I wrote the book with Lara Schwartz, who is a government professor at American University and a colleague. And the two of us spent many years talking and realizing that we were both guiding and mentoring first-year college students. We also realized that when students were failing to thrive in our classrooms, I was a sociology professor for 20 years, it wasn't usually academically oriented. It was because, for example, they had a fight with their roommate and they couldn't focus, or they didn't know how to fill their allergy prescription medication and they weren't feeling well. So it was the whole student, not just their brain, that was coming into our classroom. And again, we would chat and we said, we have all this information about guiding and mentoring first year students. Let's talk to some of these students. Let's talk to their parents and get this all in a book. So what we indeed did was put together anything we could think of that was the prep for how to get through your first year of college. So that's discussion prompts. We call them discuss before you go, discussion prompts for parents and students to have. Many are willing to have those conversations, but they don't even know what to discuss. So we're giving you lists of things that a lot of college sophomores and their parents say they had discussed or they wish they had discussed before their kid transitioned. And then there's lots of activities too. A lot of them are online searches. getting your phones ready for college, downloading certain apps like the safety app at your college or maps, looking at maps in advance. And so we go step by step of how to prep for that whole body transition, you know, spiritually, physically, academically, professionally, all different transitions from high school to college.
It's an excellent resource.
Thank you.
Just put my 2 cents in there. So assuming we've had these conversations, we've looked at this, we kind of delved into your book, how can students be the most prepared for their first day on campus?
So I would break that down into two categories. I would say there's social preparation and there's academic preparation. So social preparation, I would say, talk to your roommate in advance, regardless if you're at a school where you picked your own roommate or a roommate was assigned to you. Have some conversations in advance. Know what to discuss and probably what to avoid in those first meetings, right? So probably not a great idea to ask about your roommate's sexual orientation or disabilities or their race or ethnicity identification, right? Those are things that will come up and the student will disclose things as they see fit. But there's so many things to discuss, and that's so important when you are assigned a roommate or you're honed down on a roommate. You know, what is your intended major? Let's talk about expectations for a shared living arrangement. Tell me about your family, your siblings, your pets. Are you in a significant relationship with someone? You know, what are you scared about? What are you excited about? So having conversations with roommates in advance is really, really important. Don't wait until you actually meet in the room for the first time. I would also say students can be prepared for their first day of campus by familiarizing themselves with their campus geographically. We have students now going to campuses that are planning to go to campus in the fall they haven't even seen because of the state of the world right now. But there are virtual tours of all campuses online. Even Google Maps can show you what a campus looks like from above. And I would say it's really important for students to understand the layout of that campus, where the shuttle is, where the student center is, where the health center is, where the classrooms are. Another thing I would say it's important for students is to check out clubs and organizations in advance. That can all be found online. Find out, you know, what your interests are and what things you might want to try for the first time, you know, be that a faith-based organization, to a fraternity, to a sports team. Another one, and I'm always amazed by this one, is have a plan for move-in day with your families and discuss those expectations in advance. I've seen many move-in days end in disaster, not because the student wasn't able to fit their stuff in their room, but because those expectations weren't discussed in advance. So for example, if you ask a parent about move-in day, their first child maybe going to college, they might say, oh, it's our last time to be a family. We take a lot of pictures. We're going to have breakfast together and lunch together and walk around campus and, you know, take photos of it's our last day as a family of four. And if you ask the student, they would say, it's my first day of college, right? I'm ready for my family to head off. Let's take a few pictures. Thank you for your help with move-in. And now I need to start experiencing this. And so, you know, that's just a simple expectation that can be made in advance. And students should certainly reach out to their roommate and say, you know, what time are your parents coming? What time are they leaving? You know, should we grab a meal together? What's your plan? And really talk about those expectations in advance. And I would say, as I mentioned earlier, students should really spend some time downloading lots of important information that's available in advance. They'll feel much more confident. So when they start orientation, if they already know what that shuttle app looks like, if they already know what public transportation is local to their college, emergency contacts in the area, all that stuff should already be ready and downloaded in their phone. So that's my answer about the social piece. And I would say there's, of course, academic preparation as well. So invest and learn how to use an academic planner. It might be the same type you used in high school. I personally use a virtual and an academic, right? So I use an electronic planner and a handwritten planner that works for me. Again, there's no one way to do it, but just make sure that there's a planner that works for that student. Make sure they can get up for classes with an alarm and get them out of the house by themselves. It's a real challenge for students who've been relying on others to help them. Keeping up with emails is crucial. That is an everyday check of your new college account. That's the student checking, not the parent checking. And then really listen to what the school is suggesting. So if the school suggests, you know, check out our library virtual tour, do it. you know, really make an effort to learn every bit of this new community. Think about the fact that this is very, you know, you're moving to a new place, even if it's in the same state you grew up in. And there's a whole new language. There's a whole new sort of culture there. So the earlier you can learn, the better. And I like to say to students, you know, you wouldn't go to a foreign country without knowing some of the language in advance or the traditions. You wouldn't just show up in Turkey, for example, without having read a guidebook. And it's the same way for college. And it's all online. It's so easy to find that information.
That's spectacular. There's something about being able to visualize in terms of where the campus is, where to go. So you have all that information. And of course, you're not going to know everything on day one, but at least it kind of eases some of that stress. How can students learn who to reach out for specific issues, whether it's a housing, a roommate, grades? How do they learn and when should they learn who to reach out to?
So I would say, you know, everything is covered in orientation, and some colleges do a virtual orientation, some colleges do an in-person orientation, and some colleges do both. I would encourage students to learn as much as they can on their own through the college websites before they arrive at orientation. One of the things that mentioned in our book is that orientation can be disorienting for a lot of students. And the main reason is that they're sort of checking people out, trying to make friends. And a lot of the campus resources that are being paraded in front of students, you know, they're listening, but they're sort of half listening. And that's an appropriate response for a 19-year-old at an orientation. So the more you can learn in advance, the better. So think about what resources you might need. Maybe that's disability support. Maybe that's free tutoring. Maybe that's athlete support. Maybe that's, you know, where is the health center? And just find all those websites in advance and just read through them. And one thing to keep in mind is that college websites, or particular departmental websites, they're student facing. They are created for the student, not the parent, the student to read them. And so they're going to be broken down by, if you're an incoming student, read this. Or, you know, if you're transitioning as a junior, read this. Students shouldn't think about these things as sort of big and scary, that they're going to have to wade through a ton of information. Most college websites are very, very user-friendly.
This happens, right? You are paired up with a roommate, or you choose a roommate and you think this is going to be the best fit ever. But, you know, soon in you realize you're not a fit. So what advice have you heard or given to students who are not getting along with or not clicking with their roommate?
I love that question, Wendy. And I would say, first, we'll take a step back. Don't expect to be best friends with your roommate, right? Expect to be best roommates with your roommate. That's the goal. And that's a respectful relationship that doesn't even necessarily need to be one of your peers that you hang out with, that you're necessarily spending your social time with. But it's a respectful living situation. So starting with that, I think, is the basis for any good roommate relationship. I would say the majority of colleges now that have some sort of residential life experience, and that is most of them, do some sort of roommate contract. So sort of creating the contract yourself. It's a living document that can be shifted and changed, and it might have elements in there about what foods are not prohibited in the room, or the you know, lights on at a certain time, or noise, or visitors, things like that. If your college does not have some sort of roommate contract, I would encourage students and their roommates to create something on their own. Of course, that can be revisited as they grow and realize that things might shift and change, but really talking early and often about making that a great living situation, not necessarily a best friend situation, I think is the way to go.
Do you typically find there are options for reassignment? The hope is, right, that you are learning these skills to be respectful and mindful. And I think it's an excellent piece of advice, setting up that expectation that your roommate may not be your best friend, but how do you maintain a relationship of coming and going and property and all of that? Is there a point where reassignment is necessary? And how do you suggest students kind of problem solve that?
So every college is certainly different about reassignments. So yes, I would say every college has some sort of reassignment, because you can always get out of the situation. That said, just like you mentioned, working through problems is a great way to start. So the residence life office will start with trying to work those roommates together. And then if this is irreconcilable differences, they will help you to be reassigned. And of course, there's always situations that are referring to health and safety that would get you out of a situation earlier. But it's no different really than having, you know, being an adult and having some sort of conflict with a coworker, right? Ideally, you try to work through it first. And then if it's something that can't be handled, there can be a reassignment of a movement of space. So yeah, I would not panic about that. But again, resources are available. Your Residence Life website will have information about reassignment if you want to know that in advance.
Steps can students take if they're struggling with a transition? Like if they're failing a class, they're suffering from changes in mental health, what can they take? What steps?
I would say different struggles would lead them to different resources. So if you have roommate or peer issues, you know, the Residence Life office, and that's many, many levels. There's an RA, there's usually a resident director, it's a graduate student overseeing them. Then there's a director of Residence Life over them. That can help. If you've got academic struggles, there's tutoring centers and writing centers. Of course, your professors and your graduate TAs. If you've got mental health struggles, there's a counseling center, a dean of students office. Also, there's the Residence Life support team. Physical health, you know, you've got a physical health building, a health center on campus. So I would, again, it's encouraging students to know all their resources in advance and be able to break down their different struggles and would be leading them to different resources.
In your opinion, what is the best way for our students to communicate with their professors?
I do love this question because I was a professor for over 20 years. Two ways, I would say, certainly email, but knowing how to email. We have a template for professional email in our book. You can certainly find those templates online. And some high schools are now starting to teach professional email template skills. So that's something. Making sure a student knows not to use texting language with a professor in an email or expect a response, you know, within the hour. I would say give any professor 24 hours to respond. So email for sure, but office hours are key. And across the U.S., it seems that college students don't start regularly attending office hours until the spring of their sophomore year. And that is a huge mistake, unless they're forced in. And it's so interesting that I mentioned forced in. I was the creator of the first year experience program at American University, which is now a mandatory class for all of their first year students. And one of the activities we had our students do was they were required for a grade to attend an office hour of a professor. Yes, it was overwhelming for all, you know, thousands of students to attend in the same few weeks. That said, once the student first walks in the door of an office hour and they realize that the professor is a real person who has a picture of their daughter on their desk and maybe a pet, their dog curled up in the corner of their rug, they're going to feel much more comfortable going to office hours in the future. And the longer students put off going to office hours, the scarier it is. And then probably the unsung hero of academic support is the graduate TA. And especially large schools have graduate TAs in the majority of their large classes. And those are wonderful people for first year students to meet, to really ask for help. They'll have their own office hours. I can't encourage students to find their grad TAs soon enough.
Perfect. It is perfect because it is overwhelming. You know, if you, and again, I'm correlating this back to life skills. If you need to go in and speak to your boss, you're walking into an office, how and where and when does that take place? It's a different level, right? But I would imagine it's the same experience to be able to reach out and kind of ask the questions and say that you need help and know when and where and how, I think is an excellent growth opportunity.
Yeah, you bring up actually a good point that I forgot to mention. In high school, teachers will often say, you know, I'm here during my lunch period or come in early before school or after school and talk to me if you're having an issue or a question. It's very different in college. Most of those will need to be scheduled or by appointment. And so you're not going to just drop by a professor's hours when they're in the middle of doing their research and say, hey, I've got a problem. They have specific office hours. So that's something a student really needs to learn. That's another big transition between high school and college.
Students find what accommodations college offer if they have an IEP?
So let's start off by saying that students, not parents, should reach out for getting this information. There aren't IEPs in college, right? So an IEP is a term used in K through 12. Colleges grant what they call, quote, reasonable accommodations. And they often, but not always, mimic what the IEP looks like, the IEP that the student had in K through 12. Another piece I want to mention here is that even if a student doesn't necessarily identify as someone with a disability, in order to receive accommodations in college, they need to register as a student with a disability. So I would say students should familiarize themselves with the Disability Support website, and it might not be called Disability Support on that particular campus. It might be Academic Support, Accommodations Office, et cetera. You got to figure out the language of that campus. But how they get help is different from school to school. Some schools might assign one staff member just to new students. They might assign one staff member, might be alpha by last name of the student, depending on the size of the school and their academic studies office or their disability support office. Students should reach out as soon as they commit to a college if they are planning to seek accommodations. I can't stress that enough. They should familiarize themselves with the website of their academic support office and reach out and find out who is their person, right? Who is going to be their disability support advisor or their staff member. Ask for a meeting. It is appropriate to have a parent attend the meeting if that student wants to, but it's also appropriate to do it on their own. I would encourage, again, the student to be making that appointment and saying, you know, I'm coming in. I'm a student who is going to be registering as a student with disability. I'm seeking accommodations in college. Nothing's guaranteed. They have to be granted. And I'd love to talk to someone about what that looks like. And I would suggest that the student really asks, there's a lot of questions. So I would say, what documentation do I need to pursue accommodations in college? You know, is there a medical or is there a neuropsych documentation required of me? Does that have to be within a certain period of time? Some colleges say it's got to be within 5 years. Some colleges say within 3 years. Find out those deadlines for that documentation. That's really, really important. A lot of students get stuck by missing deadlines. And most importantly, college students should be able to clearly explain their specific learning needs and their associated challenges. Some people refer to it as the elevator speech, right? It's being able to talk openly to appropriate people. You certainly don't need to disclose to everyone, but to talk openly about your academic challenges so you can explain them. So that's everything from what accommodations you had in high school, what an IEP looked like, to what assumed accommodations you'll have in college. A student should be able to talk about any medications that they might be on, how often they take them, what they take them for, what happens if they don't take them. Anything that might have been the narrative of a parent before as advocate for their child needs to be moved over so the student can be able to explain their own situation and access any help that they can get.
It really is that understanding who you are as a learner and being able to communicate that as well. You brought up a point talking about medication real quick and having these conversations, again, understanding who you are as a learner and your needs prior to the first day of campus with medications, having the student understand about refills, when would they call in a refill, how to call in a refill, if they're out of refills, what do they do? And so kind of prepping them again for those life skills as they ease into college, but then also beyond and to be able to do that independently.
Absolutely. So important. I'm glad you mentioned that. And not waiting till the last pill before they think about a refill, right? And that's all stuff that can be done in advance. So I would say families can start with the health center on campus, find out if they have a prescription refill program. Another option is to have medication refills sent to the campus mailbox for the student to receive by mail. But there might be a CVS or a Walgreens or a Rite Aid walking distance from campus. And then other campuses, usually larger campuses, will arrange for prescriptions to be delivered directly to the health center, and the student can actually go to the health center and get their prescription refills there. So figure out what your campus does, figure out how frequently you'll need to be refilling them, but that is not something that the parent should be taking on, something that the student should be able to do.
Absolutely. So if, kind of back to our accommodations, if a student feels a professor is not honoring those accommodations, who do they reach out? How do they have that conversation? How do they go about that self-advocacy?
If the student has documentation that they should be receiving an accommodation at college, for example, time and a half on a test, or being able to take an exam in a quiet room, If they have the documentation and the professor is not honoring that, the student should go immediately back to their academic support advisor or the staff member who has helped them in their disability support office and let them know that. Do not wait on that. That is the student's legal right. And as long as the documentation exists, the faculty member must acknowledge it and must abide by that.
What additional advice would you give to parents and students regarding this huge transition?
I would say for both parents and students, breathe. Take a deep breath. Remember, it's going to be okay, right? Students, you got this. Parents, you have been training your kid for this for a really, really long time. It's not an overnight process. This has been a gradual learning of adulting skills. And hopefully you've been working towards independence for many years. So don't think about the last months pre-college sort of as a crash course on adulting. Think about the gradual process. One thing I love to say to parents, and they may not have thought about this, and I think this is where I'm coming as a college insider, you know your child and you know all their baggage, right? So you know that little Susie couldn't make it through a sleepover in fourth grade, or, you know, John couldn't tie his shoes until later than his peers. You're coming into college with a clean slate. And here's what's really nice is the college faculty and staff are ready to welcome your student as a young adult. They are going to expect them to make mistakes. They know the 18, 19, 20-year-old brain. But they are ready to welcome them without the knowledge of all of the stuff you know about your kid. So it's hard for parents to be able to kind of put that aside and realize who this new student is being introduced to the school. But as a college insider, I can tell you, we got them. We really are welcoming them, and we don't need to know all those details. It's a clean slate. You said it well, really well earlier, is sort of parents need to be moving from one role to the next. So they were sort of the co-pilot in high school, sometimes even taking a piloting role of their child's life. And they need to move to the backseat in college. And it, again, the ultimate goal is to have the student driving that car by themselves, right? With the parent sitting in the backseat with complete trust that the kid's got it. But some of this is just thinking about the majority of tasks on a daily basis and taking a step back, even in middle school or in high school, and starting to let go of some of that hold and not having that student go from dependence to independence overnight, but encouraging them to do it themselves. You got this. I have faith in you. I'm here if you need me. I'm a fallback person. And if they say to you, what should I do about this? The response can so easily be, well, what do you think you should do about it? And then that conversation can ensue. And I would say to emphasize to your kids that going away to college includes much more than learning to do laundry. It's sort of, you mentioned earlier, those listening skills and those processing skills. That's a huge process. And they begin with college acceptance. They don't end with college acceptance. Remind your kids that preparation matters, that a lot of these things can be talked about in advance. And remember that students actually know that. They just have to be reminded. They know about preparation, right? They've studied for tests. They've gone to practices for sports and for plays. They've practiced instruments, things like that. So they know that preparation really does matter. And so much of this is just preparing them for college, preparing them for the next step.
Brenner, what is something that I did not ask that I should have asked? We've covered a lot.
Yeah, I don't
some
know.
Excellent advice. Is there something that I just didn't know enough to ask as we're kind of winding down our conversation with that focus on preparing our students and having the students be prepared themselves?
No, I there's nothing I can actually think of. I think you did a great job asking questions. I think we probably honed in on most of the important topics.
So I always wrap up my podcast asking my guest, if you had a billboard and you could put one thing on it, what would it be and why? So just a second ago, you talked about, we got this, breathe, which are excellent. What would that billboard be for the student?
So for the student, my billboard would be, you got this, have faith in yourself. For sure. Those would be the two phrases I would say. You got this, have faith in yourself. I would love to remind the students sort of in subtext, if they were accepted to college, that means the college has faith in them. So they've got to have that faith in themselves, for sure. My billboard would be different for a parent, though. So I would say if I had a billboard for a tip for a parent, it would be avoid scenarios where overparenting hinders your high school students' growth into adulthood. Thinking about sometimes it's just so easy for us as parents to fix the situation because we're so used to doing that. It's been our role, but this is an opportunity to step back and let our students thrive.
Spot on. And what an excellent way to kind of close our conversation. To learn more about Dr. Brenner, you can check her out on Instagram at Andrea Malkin Brenner. You can also find her online, check her book out on Amazon or wherever you purchase your books, and look forward to connecting with you guys soon. Again, this is Wendy Taylor with IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast, and to find us on social at Learning Essentials on Instagram. Thank you so much, Dr. Brenner, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Wendy. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you for joining us today for our IEP Essentials Pro Tips podcast. To hear more pro tips and find additional IEP Essentials, including our IEP webinar, please visit www.learningessentialsedu.com.